Welcome to Linux Link Radio by TimeSys, the podcast for embedded Linux developers who want to simplify and speed up their custom platform development. Visit TimeSys.com today for access to our podcast archives.
Welcome back. This is Maciej Halasz here.
Hi, this is Gene.
And well, today we're going to cover a number of different topics.
We're getting back on our schedule.
And we are.
They got we had the stop by. You're not recording enough podcast schedule. You know, the greasy guy that comes by and makes us do this. So
well, but today we're going to have some fun with some of the technical topics. Last time we've talked, or we had interviewed a guest of ours here, Mike Erickson.
Yeah.
Today we're going to focus on a couple of technical sides of Linux. We will talk about the new Linux kernel that came out, I think, a few weeks ago, right?
Yeah, 2627.
2627, yeah. And we'll talk about a feature of a Linux kernel that is used by many customers that we work with, feature that allows them to load binary firmware into a device at boot time. And then we'll talk also about another feature, which is called, well...
Oh, yeah, you know my quest for file system.
I know that this is your thing.
That's my topic of entertainment. We're going to talk a little bit about UBI, and because there's some more movement afoot with respect to getting yet another flash-based file system.
Well, so we can spend some time talking about advantages and disadvantages to embedded Linux system and using UBFS, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. So yeah, UBFS sits on top of this UBI interface, but it's, so people see it exposed as UBFS.
Okay.
Hopefully we'll be able to have a worthwhile discussion about that too for other folks. And I have my list of wildcard things to get in there too, which you tried to nix.
No, I didn't.
When we were getting ready for
well, so you mentioned GCJ.
Yeah.
So
I want to talk
if we have enough time, we'll cover that.
Yeah. And
there's even
another wildcard that I didn't even tell you about.
Uh-oh.
Because I wouldn't have mentioned.
Well, that's what makes those podcasts interesting.
Yeah, whatever.
So 2627, yeah. Released a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. It's got support for a number of different new boards or the existing boards, both in ARM and PowerPC family. A couple of them, well, off the top of my head, I know that there's support for a couple of new Marvell processors and reference board for the new family of ARM-based processors.
What is the new? Because I have to claim ignorance. So what is ARM up to with their new set of processors?
No. So I'm talking about Marvell, right? Ah. And Marvell is an ARM licensee.
Okay. So
they designed a system on chips, a family of system of chips.
Is that what they bought from when Intel? Jettisoned all the IXPs?
No, actually, that's a completely separate family of processors. The previous ones, the PXAs, mm-hmm. I know that there's...
So I always get all these numbers and letters confused. That's why I'm not good in this job, right? So,
same here.
So IXP is still with Intel?
That's correct.
And then the PXAs are with...
PXA has been acquired by Marvell. And... as a matter of fact, the 2627 comes with a baseline support for the new PXA 930, I believe, is the new processor from that group. But the other processors that I mentioned earlier, I forgot the names of them. Maybe they will come to me by the end of this podcast. But
if you make up enough letters and numbers, you're, as long as it's under five, you're certainly hit the...
But there's a new breed of system-on-chips that Marvell brings to the market, and they are all supported right now by the kernel mainline.
Oh, that's cool.
Other features, UB and UBFS. UBFS is now officially supported by 2627, and we'll spend some time today talking about UB and UBFS. Mm-hmm. Same for firmware loading. And
actually a pretty cool feature.
Yeah. So when we talk about that and specific use cases, we can definitely talk about how people have been doing that in the past and what 2627 kernel offers today. And of course, all the new kernels.
Yeah, maybe we could, because that's something, I'm not the kernel side guy too much, but at least we can get into the mechanics of what's happening.
Yeah.
Because we were talking about that. It's like, I've been a user of that because you see that for a lot of the wireless cards, right? Mm-hmm. They have in essence, well, not have in essence, but that's exactly what they have. They have these firmware caches that sit out somewhere in your lib directory, right? And you load up the module and it loads up this firmware and, you know, plops it on the device.
There's a number of devices like that, right? For years, I think all the graphics cards had to deal with that approach. Wi-Fi devices, whenever you want to initialize the hardware in a certain way, and this you consider it to be your value-adding information.
Yeah.
Companies typically create a binary file firmware that gets loaded at runtime. Now, the challenge with that approach thus far has been that when you combine binary image with Linux kernel binary, that raises licensing questions.
Yeah, that was my next question. So I'm thinking through that's pretty cool that you have whatever magic binary file that has your microcode that you're going to run. But does that mean the device has, you know, a little bit of flash or a little bit of temporary memory that's being loaded up in essence with a program that is totally proprietary? I'm guessing, right? And then off it goes in order to do your calls.
Right. But so yes, absolutely. So that firmware file, when combined with Linux kernel binary, does the initialization, for example, sets up the, if there's like a computing part on the device, sets it up appropriately and preps it for device driver work, right? So device driver expects certain behavior from that device. Now,
it seems like a little bit of an end run around GPL there, right?
Yeah.
It's like, my magic code, it's no firm, I'm making quotes with my fingers, not firmware, not.
Well,
oh my God, what did I just do? I'm sorry.
You just probably pressed some button on your microphone.
I'll never do that again, whatever it was. Sorry about that.
So, yes, but firmware and Linux kernel combining the two. So there are typically no direct cross dependencies between the two, right? So the device driver does not depend on a firmware. The firmware itself does not derive from a Linux kernel or device drivers. It's independently written software. The dependency is there to a degree that, you know, if you don't have firmware, the device driver is not going to do what it's supposed to do.
Right? Yeah, I mean, that still smells like a scam, right? You're still pushing the bubble like, well, I could independently make the entire darn driver myself.
Well, so the problem was that in the past, it was the firmware binary has been merged with Linux kernel at compile time. So you have one image, right? One binary image that contains both GPL and non-GPL code, which given where GPL licensing is going or current definition of GPL, it's at least gray area, right? So 2627, new approach. Right now, there is a function called request firmware that you can program into your device driver, and device driver basically calls that function whenever firmware is needed. And that firmware is no longer combined with the Linux kernel binary. It lives on a root file system under lib firmware. So
as I found, right?
Yeah. So device driver, when it needs the code, the binary, simply loads it from that place, initializing the hardware or setting up some of the values for your driver.
But my question is, does that stay resident? I mean, do you make further calls into that lump of code, or does it do its initialization and then go away?
Typically, it's a non-interactive piece of software, right? So it does one thing that it's designed for, and then the device driver actually takes over. Well, in many cases, there are some frameworks that probably both of us, we interacted with, where there's certain API that firmware exposes. And then based on that API, you can still program some functions in the device driver to take advantage of it. But I haven't seen a device driver that would rely on such API recently in embedded space, at least.
No, I was just curious more than anything else. It just does seem to invite some wiggle room for people that want to, I don't know, follow the letter but not the spirit of the GPL. I mean, it really legitimizes that sort of structure.
Well, but when you compare that with writing proprietary device drivers, and I apologize for the term again.
Which one?
Well, but device drivers, the ones that companies try somehow protect from providing the source code for, they typically rely on some subsystems in the Linux kernel. They make the call, or multiple calls to those subsystems, and that's really gray area. So when you compare that with firmware, it's a much cleaner cut, right?
Oh, I completely agree with you there. There's no way I can disagree. It makes the delineation point very clear.
Right. But if for sake of argument, I agree that if somebody comes from the standpoint of, hey, whatever gets loaded into Linux kernel is really open source GPL, then definitely.
Yeah. Well, I mean, by virtue of having a very clear delineation point, right, points out the fact that there's something to delineate, right? I mean, so it's it makes it much more obvious as to the intent of the person doing the work. And I guess I'd much rather have semi quasi proprietary support for a device that I needed rather than none at all. And I think that's what we were running into. See, at some companies that never had nothing at all.
Yeah. So another aspect of this new approach into 6.27 Linux kernel is that now you can swap the firmware at runtime. Mm-hmm. You don't have to rebuild the Linux kernel, put something or reboot the device in a field to get the firmware loaded. You simply swap a file in the root file system and you reload the module. And that way you get the new firmware running on your device. So that's a nice value-adding feature of new approach into 6.27.
Yeah. And I guess it also means it's another sort of init RAMFS reason to have that around, right? Because it makes it a lot easier to get your devices initialized. Right? It's another pre-initialization step that you might have to be ready for.
Yeah.
I mean, it may not be the final thing you end up using, but because you may choose to use something different than reinitialize the device, but at least to get bootstrapped, that's probably how you're going to have to go in and do that.
Yeah, so I think that this approach is going to be adopted by many vendors out there in the embedded space for those reasons that we just mentioned alone, right? And just to make you have to say that word for me.
Demarcation, maybe? That sounds like a good point.
That's much easier.
Delineate. Well, that shows up my telco thing, right? They have that demarcation point.
Demarcation line. Okay.
And they make a big deal out of it. It's like the two wires hanging on the side.
But you get my point. Okay. All right. So next topic that we wanted to cover is...
after you cut me off, I'm not talking anymore. You can talk the rest of the time.
Okay. But we are going to your favorite topic, file systems. Do you still want me to talk all the time?
I thought my favorite topic was like, never mind. So, because we in this one too, we have the unsorted block, right? Mm-hmm. Unsorted block images file system coming out, which is a two-layer. It's a two-layer thing, right? You have the file system that sits on top of it, mm-hmm. but you have this UBI interface that attempts to do a better job of creating an abstract layer in between what's really happening on those flash devices and then what the kernel needs to do in order to manage those flash devices properly.
Right, but UB is also relying on a MTD device, right? It's designed for true flash devices and not for devices like hard drives or...
Yeah, that's a good point. So, yeah, so it is focused squarely on the MTD, the flash, NAND and NOR flash devices. And it's set up for things that are based on erase blocks rather than, so a drive is a block device. And a MTD device is a what they call an erase block device, mm-hmm. and so it has the some code built into it to handle creating this abstraction layer between the what they call the erase blocks on the disk and the blocks that it's manipulating from a file system perspective. Because mm-hmm. One of the issues you get into, right, for any of those sort of technologies is the fact that you can't write to one spot frequently, mm-hmm. and so.
Well, you can, but then that device would not serve you for long.
That's right. You can write to it frequently for a certain amount of time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. So so what this system did is it's an improvement over JFFFS, bunch of Fs, right, in that it writes its sector list, not just sector list, but its block list out on the drive. So the mount times are a little bit less because it doesn't have to sort of read all that in and calculate it in memory. It sort of creates a cache of them as it's working right on the drive.
So that actually what's been a challenge with JFS2, right? Because it has been created in the past to serve smaller flash devices, but with the introduction or cost of typical NAND flash device going down and new flash devices of the size of 256 megabytes not being anything unusual or even larger, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry.
I just wanted to point out that I've seen many, many times over the past few months customers complaining about GFS2. How much time it takes to boot a system from GFS2.
Well, there's strategies you can use to speed that up. I mean, one of the things is you can take your block list and your free block list and append it to the end of the image, basically, to get the startup time increased.
Well, but does it imply that you can't write to a device?
No, it doesn't imply that.
So that directory structure, because that's what it is, right? That you append to the Linux kernel would not change if you, for example, write to the device, create subdirectories?
Not exactly.
Okay.
So it's a caching technique, right? So instead of trying to figure out everything, it gives you a faster way. It just records, hey, what would otherwise be built up into memory.
Okay.
It keeps appended to the end of the JFFS2 block. And then that way, whenever it starts up, instead of it walking through to find out what its free list is and what's empty, it looks to another section and just reads it right off instead of walking every node.
Right.
Because it was one of those classic scaling problems with JFFS2. I mean, when that was written, a gigabyte of flash was
unimaginable.
Who would ever want that? I mean, yeah, who would ever want that? It was like
it's a hard drive.
Yeah, and so what you know, UBI attempts to do is keep track of that right on the disk.
So how does it do that? Where is that information stored right now?
They have a tree that they have some. So they have some nodes reserved on the disk.
Okay,
and they just write into the disk.
So each node stores its own information on the data stored in it?
There's some of that, but there's the tree that contains the free list and the use list is persisted on the device itself.
Okay.
So there's a bit of a recursion problem there because it also has to wear level its own metadata, but that's all hidden in what they call their physical block layer, right? So they have this notion of a logical erase block that they layer on top of a physical erase block. And so as a user, you interact with this logical erase block, and then it maps between the two, the free list, and sort of manages that. So you're relieved as a UBIFS author, right? You're relieved of knowing physically what's happening.
Yeah. So a software that writes to a device that's using UBIFS sees exactly the same device at all times. And what happens underneath, I mean, how the UBFS manages wearing, leveling, and bad blocks, that's hidden in the lower level of a UBFS.
Yeah, that's hidden in between the mapping between the logical and the physical erase blocks.
That's smart.
And the other thing that they did too is they wrote it so that it really did write back support.
That's been actually a challenge with JFS too.
Yeah. And so I dug in more than I want to admit, but I dug in and looked because it also does compression, right?
Oh, does it? So you on the fly?
Yeah. So you can get into a little bit of a pickle whenever you're doing something like write-back support because you have the ability to oversubscribe your system because it thinks, right? So if you write 100 bytes into the cache and there's a 50 bytes left on the disk,
let me kind of step back for a second. Write back, that means that you keep the data on in a cache in memory, and you don't write as often as your application requests the write to a device.
That's correct.
Okay. Sorry.
And that's different than JFS2 because JFS2 will serialize its writes. And this system will hold them in cache, and what it will attempt to do is whenever it can, at an opportune time, it will attempt to write things. Because when you have a system like like a flash system, it needs to array something, organize its blocks properly, then write something new. So it's, it doesn't really, if you update something on your file system, it's actually a very expensive operation for it to readjust where things are located. And they have a, like a budgeting system built in where, because you're writing into a cache and it's compressed, it's not like, there's not a one-to-one relationship between bytes written and bytes available.
Right, so you don't know exactly how much space it's going to take on a physical device before you write to it.
And sometimes writing, you know, when you're moving stuff around on the device, it, you might find that you have a block that's bad, that before wasn't bad.
Right.
So then when you write to it, you then you have less memory, you have less available than you thought you had.
So how does UBFS deal with that? I mean, I could imagine that calculating, you know, how much space is available on a physical device on the fly, it's a fairly complex.
So they did it the easy way, and I would say the smart way. I'll preface that way. It's the, both the smart and easy way, in that they create a buffer. For the device. And whenever you begin to, whenever you exceed whatever they consider their high watermark, it'll start serializing until things become quiescent again. And it decides that it, there's enough capacity to then hold stuff in memory.
I see.
I'm sure someone will write into me and say, you got it all wrong, but I was reading the code and that's.
So it's kind of, would you agree that that's more of a pessimistic approach, and typically it allocates or budgets for less than it actually has available.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah.
So it's like, I mean, and that makes sense. You know, most people that need to use a, you know, this kind of device, they have a good understanding of how much they're going to be writing to it, and they do it in a controlled manner. I thought it was clever. I mean, there's some interesting engineering things they had to do in order to have all that fit together nicely, but they did a nice job.
Yeah. So it sounds like, rather than finding workarounds to get your old GFS2 file system to work as you need, UBFS can be a very nice alternative to these new projects that are going to rely on newer versions of Linux kernels.
Yeah,
because both writing back and the way you, I mean, the time it takes to boot the device that uses UBFS is very advantageous to
because a lot of our users, because of the GFS booting issues and the time required, will have their main system, right? Their operating system partition, they'll have that as a ROMFS or a CRAMFS file system because they mount incredibly fast and they just boot up right away. I don't know if you ever do those, you know, boot Linux in many seconds kind of things. You'll find out that, I mean, that's what they do. That's one of the first things you get rid of.
Yep.
Because you delay the time required to do the GFS mount after the system is effectively started
So you do staged booting basically, you mount in parallel with performing some other actions.
Yeah.
But so it sounds like UBFS solves that issue to some degree. But the budgeting thing, I would imagine that is another potential scalability issue for the future.
Yes.
And we'll cross, I guess, that bridge when we get there.
Yeah, I was trying to sort of absorb what would be involved in that, but the pessimistic nature of the scaling means that so you may get a gigabyte, and then it may decide that only, you know, 800 megabytes is something you can write to. Okay, so then you just you put a multiplier, or you put a coefficient in front of the amount of memory you stick on a system as to its effective amount of memory, and you budget onward. I mean, it seems like a very sane budgeting system.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing actually a couple of new demos that we are assembling here in the house show the advantage of UBFS. I know that a couple of engineers here at TimeSys have been actively working with UBFS for a while. So very excited about it.
Yeah, I've been tinker toying away with it, but I haven't had the chance to really get in there and make it fall over, right? Because that's the fun part, right?
Well, we would be very much interested in your opinions about UBFS if you're planning on using UBFS in your project, or perhaps if you plan on using a new feature of 2627 to use firmware in your design, please let us know. Share your opinions with us. But before we end this episode, I know that there are a couple of hidden agenda topics.
Well, no, so I have some side issues, right? So the first total side issue is Java. So GCJ, there seems to be a decent resurgence in interest in using GCJ on embedded devices.
Really?
Yeah. And so I dug in, and because I watched that project.
Yeah.
And I think it's a cool thing to do, right? It's a
open source.
The other thing is it treats Java like it should be treated, right? Mm-hmm. Which is a compiled language right down to the machine. And yeah, the whole virtual machine thing I still view as, we have some guy here that, you know, Java is his best friend. And he probably,
you don't have to lean over to see him.
Well, I think he lip reads. So if he notices me saying it. But anyway, so, but yeah, so I mean, being able to compile right down to machine code for targets, yeah, very interesting. And one of the cool things about people being attracted to GCJ is they have a very good implementation of Java 5.
So,
which is,
can I ask you a question?
So, a little bit ahead of the curve.
GCJ, you're talking about compiling directly Java source code.
Yeah.
To not to the bytecode, but to machine code.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're talking about using like Giselle.
Well, I don't. We were talking about that earlier, and the whole Giselle thing is. Is because Giselle is execution of bytecode right on the processor.
Mm-hmm.
And this, you know, for ARM, it would produce ARM machine code.
Right.
And you could run that in Linux.
Okay.
Because one of the things I was trying to figure out with Giselle is that if you could put it in, you know, put your processor in Giselle mode, right, and just pump it a bunch of bytecode to run in.
Directly on the processor.
I don't think you can. I think once the operating system's up and going, operating system's up and going.
Yeah, no, definitely. There, as far as I know, that coexistence is not there. But so GCJ, what does it mean, machine code? You mean like Linux binary?
Yeah. So what it is, it's a front end. It's a GCC front end. Okay. So it takes the Java code, it reads it, it builds a parse tree, it does the right stuff, and then out the other side, you get the I forget what they call the GCC intermediary language,
mm-hmm.
and then from that, voila, it runs to the optimizer and it produces, you know, a bunch of assembler code that runs through the assembler and then gets linked for execution.
So is that a way of avoiding a virtual machine on your target?
Yeah.
That's actually clever.
Yeah.
Hmm. I have to look more into it.
Yeah. And I know with GCJ, what they have built into it is an interpreter. So mm-hmm. they do have a bytecode interpreter
mm-hmm.
for the current machine, which makes sense in case you load up some arbitrary class lib. And then they also have the ability to compile the class libs. Yeah. So
you'd have to actually compile class libs as libraries
mm-hmm.
and then application as something that uses those libraries at runtime.
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
And because I know that GCJ has been having some problems with quality of how it performs the tasks and the quality of the machine code. So improvements that you're talking about dealing with those quality issues.
Yeah, there's been an improvement. I mean, even my little, I would call it the extremely poor man suite of tests.
Yeah,
are doing better on the new, but doing much better on the newer GCJs.
So is it better in terms of compilation, or is it better in terms of how it runs?
Better in terms of that it works.
Okay. Yeah. No, that's a big step forward.
Yeah. Well, I think now they have Eclipse running under, you know, under GCJ.
Hmm.
Which is, I mean, that's talking about an acid test, right? So that's a pretty good acid test.
Quite a few classes.
Yeah, one or two. And that, I mean, it loads stuff on the fly. And I mean, Eclipse is a great big wrapper around the class loading system.
Right.
I mean, it is. It really is. So it runs a lot of arbitrary Java bytecode.
Hmm.
And I know that's something that GCJ didn't do very well before. You could snap it pretty easy.
Well, so that's another topic that I would imagine we want to hear from you, whether you're looking to adopt GCJ perhaps for your project.
Yeah, you know,
and the reasons for that.
No, that's a really good idea because it's difficult because we get the sales, you know, the sales critter shows up and you don't really have a feeling of what's going on out there. You know, you can hear from your buddies or whatever else. But yeah, if there's a GCJ adoption story out there, we'd love to hear. I think it would be great.
And each project is different. So I've seen the same technology being used in completely two different ways. And one way for us to promote different approaches is to share your stories. So please contact us, write to us. Our email address is...
podcast@timesys.com.
You see, I... can't remember those things. My wife remembers all contact information from me.
No, your iPhone remembers. Or is that what you're calling your iPhone now?
No. I wouldn't go that far.
But so you can always, I think if you go to podcast.timesys.com is, and also linuxlinkradio.timesys.com, they splurged and spent the whole $14 to register that domain name for us. But yeah, so it's all available. You know what the other thing I've been fiddling with too? Oh, we're almost done anyway. So the other thing I've been fiddling with too is, you remember PIC?
From
way back when, yeah.
What is PIC?
PIC? Oh my goodness. So PIC was in, this is not a joke, PIC was invented by Dick PIC.
So that's the hidden agenda.
No. So it's an operating.
Okay.
So
I'm interested.
So it's an operating system that runs with variable length records.
Okay.
And everything is stored in what they call a dictionary. And okay. So you have a certain vocabulary of things to do, and data is stored. It's a multi-value database. And mm-hmm. So anything in the database can be one or zero or more values. And any value can be zero or more values, you know, all the way down. And mm-hmm. So it's a system that, you know, makes that kind of storage and data representation easy. And so way back,
hundred years ago,
I that was one of my jobs, was to write PIC code, right? And so I was wondering to myself, hey, I wonder if that's available on Linux, because some tortured soul, right, had to have ported. Lo and behold, there really is a halfway decent PIC. It's called OpenQM. And so I've cracked it open, created some vocabulary, wrote some PIC basic, which I thought I'd repressed. I probably have to go back to counseling for that.
A pickle.
Yeah. I have no idea what its applicability to embedded systems is. I'm guessing zero.
What does it do under Linux?
I wonder,
if it was supposed to be its own little operating system, what's the advantage of using it on Linux?
It's like, if you could think of it as something on the same level as like PHP.
Hmm.
So it's a language, and it allows you to, one of the nice things about the system is that you can store very arbitrary data types.
Mm-hmm.
So if you wanted to keep track of something like visits to your website, I'm not making something up, and so you have a visit and mm-hmm. who visited,
mm-hmm.
and you wanted to have a list of their visits. And then for the list of their visits, you want a list of their activities.
Mm-hmm.
And with a traditional database, you'd set up three tables.
Mm-hmm.
And with something like PIC, you set up
one table
with one record, and each record would have multiple values built into it.
Mm. Okay.
It's a very different way of thinking about things.
It's basically flattening hierarchical approach.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. So you don't have a lot of the databasey sort of things.
For small applications, definitely that would facilitate the design and probably performance as well.
Yeah.
For larger database, pure database applications and systems, that might be not having enough features.
Probably the wrong approach.
Yeah.
Right. For a bigger database, but for something little, if you're storing a couple K or 10 or 20 or 30 K worth of data, and you need it to be unstructured, maybe an interesting approach.
Interesting.
I have to get in there and see if I can break it and see what I can get out of it data storage wise, right?
Okay. So we'll be looking forward to hearing about the next story from way back when.
Yeah, well, during our I think it's just worth looking at. So I have no idea what's applicability for embedded systems, but what the heck?
Well, it's all technology.
Yeah. So, like I said, any questions or comments, love to hear from you. If you're a GCJ user, if I screwed up my description of UBIFS, if we didn't do a good job explaining what's new in 2627, write in. I'd love to hear from you. We did this, so we'll be able to get back in touch pretty soon. So let us know, and we'll hear back from you. We'd love to hear from you, and we'll be another episode in a week or two.
And we're inviting you to listen to our next episode.
Yep. Take it easy.
Thanks.
This podcast was brought to you by TimeSys. Are you new to embedded Linux? Looking for a way to simplify your next project? The Linux Link service by TimeSys makes it easy to build your custom embedded Linux platform. Go to timesys.com today or call 866-392-4897 to learn more.